I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a widow reflects on the bond she has with her partner in death.
I have 3 relationships with him, right? And first, that sort of early upstart of falling in love and the beautiful eros of new love. And then, of course, the 10 years I spent as his caregiver. And now this long journey that we are on together, you know, when he's in a different realm, but he's still part of my life.
This hour, author Tembi Locke joins us to talk about her storybook romance with her late husband and finding home after his death in the Sicilian countryside where he grew up. That's after a short break. Tembi Locke signed up for a student exchange program to Italy when she was 20, hoping to take in some great art, polish her Italian, maybe enjoy a youthful fling or two with Florence's version of the kind of hard-to-get commitment phobe she liked back home in Texas. She figured a relationship might distract from her lifelong ambition to work as an actress. But the love of her life had other plans from the moment he laid eyes on her. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Saro was a chef born in Sicily, working in Rome, where his patrons marveled at his ability to turn the act of eating into a sacred experience. He was as warm and open as Locke's earlier boyfriends had been cool and aloof, and she fell hard. They both did. They were so well-suited, so happy together, and so thrilled to welcome their daughter into the family that losing Saro to cancer meant Locke not only had to find a way to carry on in the face of so much loss, but to figure out who she was without Saro by her side. She shares that surprising story in her book From Scratch, a memoir of love, Sicily, and finding home. She joined us earlier this year to talk about it. Tembi, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you for having me here. That was incredibly touching. Hear your reading of my life.
Oh, that's very kind. Well, I really enjoyed reading the book, despite the fact that it's about some difficult things. You write that after your husband had died, you realized you'd had 3 separate relationships to him. He was your partner, you were his caregiver, and then you were his widow.
Yes. I remember when I got to that section of writing the book and I was sort of trying to really explain to readers, someone had asked me just before that, maybe in the week before, about the question that I was like still married. I think I mentioned that I felt like I was still married to him. And that sort of took them back, you know, and I thought, well, how do I bring that sentiment into my story? Because when someone passes, we don't cease to have a relationship with them. They're very much still a part of our life. And I talked to him. He was my best friend. And so when I was writing that part of the book, it dawned on me. I said, wow, I have 3 relationships with him, right? And first, that sort of early upstart of falling in love and the beautiful eros of new love. And then, of course, the 10 years I spent as his caregiver. And now this long journey that we are on together, you know, when he's in a different realm, but he's still part of my life.
Your daughter, who was 7 when she lost her dad, struggled with that. She said, it hurts too much to still love him, and I wish I didn't love him anymore.
Yeah, childhood grief gives you pause. It does. I remember where we were when she said that to me, and I was almost like praying for the words that would come to me to comfort her because first and foremost, that's what I wanted to do as a mom. But then I also felt like if I could articulate for her an aspect of love that somewhere it might penetrate it. It might filter down deep into her heart and know that you can't stop loving someone and that love might soothe places that at the time, you know, at 7, you know, she's very literal. So she was like, well, if he's not here, then maybe I don't have to. And a part of life is learning that we are all in this engaged journey with love in a lot of senses, in many ways.
How much did she understand the permanence of death at 7?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I think we all are still, I can say I'm still wrestling with when I say the permanence of it, the fact that his loss still comes to me sometimes afresh and anew. And so, of course, obviously, literally, I know that there's a permanence in death. And at seven, you know, I mean, at that point in grade school, they've done, you know, the seasons and sort of, you know, the life cycle of a plant. And we had certainly talked about death. But I think at seven, what I saw that first year and into the second year was that she was always coming back to it and needing to reaffirm, like, wait, he really won't be here when I, you know, finish elementary school and go to middle school. You know, he really won't be here for that. And that awareness, the way that would wash over her, was something that we had to talk about a lot. And so I think, you know, a part of childhood loss is reconciling that.
Does she remember him now?
She does. She does. Memory, as we all know, changes, fades. So we do things together to sort of prompt that memory. So we've got videos, there's photographs, telling stories helps. But she has said at times, I don't remember this, and I don't remember the sound of his voice. And so I think that the fading of those memories can be hard, but what I know is that I say, well, let's watch a video together, you know? And I think that there's a comfort in that. So, yeah, but the memory is tricky. And obviously writing a memoir really reminded me of that.
So I want to step back here and talk about this person you both loved so much.
Yes.
Your story with your husband is like about as romantic as they come. He came into your life when you were not looking for a relationship. You were incredibly young. Your dad showed up, like, as you say, in full Texas regalia, prepared to break the whole thing up.
Yes. So I'm 20 years old. I am in Florence, and I literally went for a semester. And I quickly fell in love with the place, and I thought, oh, gosh, if I could just stay a little longer. And, of course, in the process of that, I meet this man. And you're right. I mean, that who goes abroad for a semester, is walking down the cobblestoned streets of Florence, and I rounded a corner and I bumped into him. And were he here, he would say it was love at first sight. And of course, you know, he was handsome at first sight. And there was all of sort of that. But I was 20, you know, and what do we really know of ourselves, of life, of love? And so he, however, was really willing to see something that I couldn't see and induct me into that vision. And so in a way, I think early on, he held the promise of what could be when I was too young, naive, inexperienced enough to see how could this ever actually work out. And yet I was really taken with him, and in a way that he was both in the way he talked about things, the place, the ways we knew things together, that I was like, how does he know that? And also the food piece. I mean, he really wooed me with the food.
You say it was love at first bite for you.
It really was love at first bite. And so when my dad got wind of this, you know, back in Texas, I was never one to really talk to him about who I was seeing and, please, my dad, no.
Right. And your dad probably didn't want to know that much about it either.
Of course not. Yeah. Why? And yet, when I, in passing, you know, mentioned in this long-distance phone call, and back then you called your parents once a week.
Right.
You know, so I called him, and I have to say, within short order, he was like, we're coming. And I think he really wanted to vet this, and he wanted to see that his child, he could sense that I was taking a leap and a leap into an unknown, and he just needed to have, you know, sort of boots on the ground, literally, and see who and what that was. And he met him, and of course, he liked him pretty much right away.
So many, and this might sound sexist, but traditionally when men buy gifts for women, it's like jewelry and flowers and candy. Sato bought you a bicycle.
He did. Okay, so as a student in Florence, I was living with a family on the outskirts of the city, and I had to take the public transportation to get the bus to get to and from the classes. And I mentioned this in one of our early conversations, and, you know, it was in passing for me, but he filed it away. And when I saw him thereafter, he said, here, I have something for you, and it was a bike. And in a way, Chris, it was like someone was seeing this need that I had and was like, I think this could be beneficial. And it really changed the course of our relationship, because I saw him as someone who paid attention, who was resourceful, and intuitive. And of course, those are great things in a marriage, friendship, relationship. And that bike really became not only the way I got around Florence, but it kind of really helped me to connect with him. And of course, the humorous story in it is that it was, you know, Florence has this sort of underground bike market of I won't say stolen bikes, but bikes
misplaced and reapportioned.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, it was I still to this day question, you know, sort of how he got this bike, but it didn't matter. it was a great turning point.
So when did you start having conversations about him moving to the U.S. to be with you?
You know, he first broached it. He said he knew I was returning to the States to finish college. And we sort of had arranged, you know, what that senior year of college would look like. And we sort of looked at the calendar and figured out, you know, how many times he could come and what we could afford. And then somewhere in my senior year, he said, initially, I actually thought I might move to Italy, but I wanted to be an actor. And I didn't really see the possibility of doing that, you know, in Florence, quite frankly, or even in Rome at the time. There was very limited things for a woman of color to do, you know, in Italy. And so we were having this conversation. And he said to me, Tembi, people eat all over the world. I'll come to the States.
Hmm. So he had met your family.
Mm-hmm.
You had not met his family. How much did you know about why you hadn't met them?
Good question. We were together a while before he told them about me. So that was already the first sign. And, you know, he and his family had had a kind of fractured relationship insofar as many of his choices were so far flung from his old world, small town, rural, Sicilian, agrarian way of life. And so by the time I came into his life and he was choosing to spend a life with me, so I'm American, African-American, I'm an actress, I've got divorced parents.
I mean, the list of selling points
yes, yeah.
to so, his parents
exactly.
go on and on.
So his parents are, you know, for them, it was just beyond anything in their wildest imaginings. I mean, these are people, you know, and I write it in the book. I mean, he had a girlfriend who was from Sardinia, which is, you know, another island in the Mediterranean, which is a part of Italy, and they couldn't get their minds around that. So
they thought of that as a mixed relationship.
Oh, of course it was. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so for them, this was just a step too far. And so he had been telling me that, but I don't think I really understood the depth of it until they refused to come to our wedding. And our wedding was in Italy. So for my big Texas family to come thousands of miles and to be basically, you know, the distance of, I don't know, what are we, Houston to Dallas, mm-hmm. quite frankly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and yet they wouldn't come. And that's when I really knew this was deeper than I thought.
How much did he talk to you about the extent to which that bothered him?
I think early on he didn't a lot. I think he was at a stage in life where he thought, you know, I've started my life in another place. I love my family. He always knew his family loved him, but he just felt like they don't understand me. And I can't really make them understand me. And so he was willing to sort of move at status quo in a kind of non-choice. Mm-hmm. But at times he would begin to share things, and the way he shared things about his culture, and that was really the way he taught. He tried to really give me a sort of a primer on Sicilian culture and really agrarian Sicilian culture. And a lot of it was through film. We watched lots of Cinema Paradiso, The Star Maker, where he was trying to sort of say, this is who I come from, and this is why they're very different from you. This is why they may not understand you. This is why it may take them time, and please be patient with them. And I think he was also afraid that I might not like them.
Hmm.
And so all of that sort of held off the time of, you know, that we would set aside for us to come together.
I'm Chris Boyd, and we're listening back to my conversation with Tembi Locke, author of From Scratch, a memoir of love, Sicily, and finding home. When we come back, Locke talks about the first time she visited her mother-in-law after Sorrow's death.
I didn't know how much I desperately needed that and wanted to hold on to that connection. And so the stakes were high that first summer. They were very high. And I was also bringing his ashes back.
Yeah.
And so there was all the sort of technical stuff to do that. And then once that was done, it was just me and my mother-in-law and my daughter, and we're in the home that she was born in, the home that he grew up in, and we were starting over.
That's after a short break. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Tembi Locke, who joined me earlier this year to talk about her book, From Scratch, a memoir of love, Sicily, and finding home. Let's go back to that conversation. Sara did not tell his parents about his cancer diagnosis until he'd finished treatment the first time.
Yeah.
And which I assume you both thought was finishing treatment permanently in the moment.
To a degree, we did. I mean, the saving grace of our oncologist was that he never put a timestamp or really a definitive timeline or number, if you will, to what we had. So we just thought we are going to live this thing day to day. And initially we thought, let's get through the course of treatment and let's take the tumor out. And then we'll tell. Well, this was really his choice. Then he would tell his parents, which was very unusual. I'm very close to my parents. I tell them everything. And so that was a sort of beginning, a little bit of a friction early on. And I saw the way cancer was making us, so it was dividing us as a couple a little bit, because he had one way that he wanted to approach things with his family. And I felt like, no, I think you need to really reach out to them and let them know. But he said to me, there's nothing they can do so far away, and they will only be worried and they will only be hurting. And then he says, I can't hold all of that for them.
Yeah, so it would have complicated things for him, too.
Yes. And so he said, let me just get through the treatments, and then we'll remove it. I'll have the surgery. And then when it's out of me, I can have this conversation with my family. And I really had to bow to that. I mean, that was his path. And as his wife, my job was to sort of support that. And any feelings I had about it, I either kept to myself or I talked about them with other people. Because, and in a way, in retrospect, it was the wisest thing he could have done.
How did that first round of illness and treatment shape the thoughts and conversations you had about bringing a child into the world?
Well, we'd always wanted to be parents. And so the diagnosis, obviously, as it happens with a young couple, is very interruptive of dreams, of life. And so we were really focused so much on his remission or getting him to a stable point that when that happened, then it was like, okay, let's reach and grab for life. And yet, we were also deeply concerned about what that might look like. I was very clear at that point. We had we had banked sort of his sperm, which is a part of the whole, I read about this in the book, this is a part of the whole process of going through chemotherapy, the kinds of chemotherapy he did. We were advised that if you ever want to become parents, you should, you know, do this, and then later you can revisit it. And so when it came time to the later revisit it, I decided I didn't want to revisit it, that I didn't really want to begin our family with a clinician and doctors and lab coats. And I really had wanted to adopt, and we had always wanted to adopt. But we definitely talked a great deal about what would it mean to bring a child into a family with a cancer diagnosis in the background. And at the time, it was in remission. And we had an oncologist, his oncologist, say to me, you let me worry about the cancer. Go have your life. And that was the greatest gift anyone, a physician certainly, has ever given me. Because what he was saying was, we cannot predict anything. But you need to reach and live for and live the life you want to live. And I think he understood that that also would give my husband more to reach for in life.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then we had friends who had said, you know, people never know what's going to happen. None of us can predict life. And so, therefore, if you want to become a family and you want to start a family, go for it. And so that's what we did.
How often was his diagnosis in the back of your mind, even when he was in remission?
All the time. I mean, I don't think it was ever far from either of our minds. Those of your listeners who have gone through this journey know that you have scans every 3 months initially, and then if you're lucky, you move to them every 6 months. So we were constantly touching base with our oncologists all the time. I was very hypervigilant as a caregiver. So any cough, you're not feeling well, you're sleeping, you know, we were always sort of scanning the landscape for, is this thing coming back? But at the same time, it was also made us really aware of time and the preciousness of life. And so we were making decisions to live our life as fully as we could in the face of that. So the two went hand in hand. I don't think you ever just, it doesn't go away. It is, and because it was in my life for 10 years, I still think about it.
Yeah. Were there ways, there's sort of a balance of power and responsibility that changes when one person is a caregiver and one person needs care. Were there ways that he tried to care for you when he was sick?
Yes. The story that comes to mind right away, he had just come out of the hospital after the first surgery he had, and he was going to be home and home care. And I got an offer to be on a television show that would take me to Utah for 2 weeks. And I was terrified to go. And he looked at me and he said, I need you to do this because I need you to do this for you. Because you've been caring for me and it's time for you to do something for you. And I think he understood that in order for us to go the distance, to go the long journey of caregiving and all of the uncertainty that goes with a cancer diagnosis and the critical care, was that I had to have moments for myself. And I had to have moments that weren't about that, that were about me, my artistry, my friends, my own internal life. And so he was incredibly supportive of that. So while he didn't work because the diagnosis robbed him of his career as a chef, so he wasn't a provider in that sense, but he provided me a great deal of support. And he kept coming back to the fact that, well, we found our way to this understanding that we were still husband and wife. And that, and there were many times I told him, I was like, I know this is going on. I know you're not feeling well, but I still need you to show up for me. Mm-hmm. And he found ways to do that. And sometimes it was, you know, it was cooking when he could, which was always our love language, which was wonderful. But it was also being incredibly supportive in my endeavors away from the life that we had at home, which was really centered around his care. And then when our daughter came into our lives, you know, the family care.
You opened the memoir with you returning, having returned to Sicily after he had died, and you had his ashes with you, and you had visited there together. And so I wonder what it was like to go back the first time without him to say, oh, can you explain this to me? How is this done? To laugh at things together. What was that like?
I was terrified of that first trip back for many reasons. One, I was still very much in the throes of early grief. It was feral for me. Mm-hmm. And I felt very unsure in the world. And I mean that in the most like basic of ways. Sleep was interrupted, all the things that sort of happened, you know, hydrating, the things that one needs to do to take care of themselves. So the idea of taking myself and my 7-year-old child, moving us from, you know, our home thousands of miles away to a small Sicilian village, I thought, what is that going to look like? What happens when, you know, who do I talk to? And he had always been that sort of literal interpreter, mm-hmm. because, you know, Sicilian is not a dialect of Italian. I speak Italian. It is its own language with its own verbs and articles and rules of conjugation. And so, and I've never learned Sicilian. And so in the years before his passing, when we were there, he was always the person I could lean to and go, what did they say? What did they? And so I knew I was returning to my mother-in-law's home without him. And what would we, how would we, she and I, communicate? And we had Italian as a shared, you know, intersecting point of language. So she would, you know, use the Italian she could employ to speak to me, and I would use mine, and we kind of had to find our way. So that was sort of at the most linguistic levels of things. But emotionally, I wasn't sure what it would be like. How would we form a new relationship when the person who held us together was no longer there? And would she still want me around, quite frankly? And I didn't know how much I desperately needed that and wanted to hold on to that connection. And so the stakes were high that first summer. They were very high. And I was also bringing his ashes back.
Yeah.
And so there was all the sort of technical stuff to do that. And then once that was done, it was just me and my mother-in-law and my daughter, and we're in the home that she was born in, the home that he grew up in, and we were starting over.
She would not let you cook in her kitchen.
No. 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 Ever. So, which is not uncommon, by the way, for Sicilian mothers-in-law. But also, at the time, she said to me, you need to rest. And it was her way, I think, of being able to care for me in the wake of my loss and in the wake of all the years of caregiving. And so she said, literally, let me take care of you. You don't cook, you don't clean, you don't do laundry, nothing. And, you know, for me as a Southerner and who was always grew up like, you know, you help out, it always was like, really? Let me. And she said, no, just be still. You're going to need that. And she knew at the time she was widowed, had been widowed 3 years. And you know, she had lost her father when she was seven. So she'd watched her mother go through this process. Mm. And she said, you need to rest. And boy, was she right. And boy, am I grateful for that wisdom and for the space that she gave me to grieve in the way that I needed to and a way to sort of find my way back and the closeness with my daughter at that time as well.
You were also struck by the way that her own community showed up for her. Can you talk about what happens in a small Sicilian village when someone has lost a child?
Well, I'm going to tell you the story of the one street I know really, really well, and all the women of, I named the street Via Gramsci in the book, mostly because I want to give them some privacy. But basically, this Via Gramsci, you know, they're my mother-in-law's cousin, lives across the street. People she grew up with are just two doors down. And there is this interchange of care that happens, and people show up for each other's, the most critical moments of each other's lives, and quite literally some of the rituals around care, and certainly the ritual, even death in Sicily, is to everyone lends a hand. And so when there's illness, people across the street, they make food and they bring it to you. When it's an agrarian town, so my mother-in-law, toward the latter years of her life, she never drove, so she certainly didn't drive to the supermarket. There is no supermarket in town. And so people bring food to her. And so I watched this town, this one street of women, largely women, really lean into each other in the most vulnerable of times. And some of my best memories of Via Gramsci is sitting out on the bench in front of the house and seeing people talk, care, share food, ask how each other is doing. And it's almost like we're all in one house, which at times can feel claustrophobic, but at the same time, there's a richness to it. There's a kind of community that I know for myself in Los Angeles today, I cannot mimic, just can't even come close to it. And I think that what I learned about how a community can care for itself and each other, I really learned and see every summer when I go to Sicily. So it's quite wonderful and beautiful.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. When you first went, your thought was that you wanted your daughter to have this really profound connection to her father's roots. Did she just take to the place right away? Did it take her a while as like an American kid who spoke Italian?
So here's the trick. So every woman on our street knows that kids, they keep the candy dish on the in the foyer, kind of the open space when you come in. So from the earliest of ages, like 3, 4, she would go door to door and grab candy out of each of the candy dishes, right, and bring them back. So she had been doing that for a while each summer, and she made friends, and she would, you know, move about. And there's a sort of, you know, the doors aren't locked. You know, she can go down the street, and everybody's keeping an eye on her. So when she was 7 and we went back for that first summer, I was very much afraid that it would be too much, that she would get there and want to leave. And yet what happened is she arrived and she felt as though she had more love at her disposal. I mean, everyone was sort of like, so Ella, you know, vieni, 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 you know, come here, let me tell you this, let me show you this. And so in a way, she said to me, she said, Mommy, I don't know if I want to go back to Los Angeles. She said, because there we have to stay behind our gate. Mm-hmm. She goes, here we don't have to. And it was, she said it in that 7-year-old language, you know, it was very sort of, you know, literal in that sense. But I think what she was saying is, I feel free here. I feel open. I feel cared for and supported. And plus, you know, my mother-in-law is like, you know, giving her like the best foods and they're watching soap operas all day. And they're, you know, they're having a really lovely, slowed down, connected time. And it's been a gift. It's been a gift. And sometimes she does feel like the foreigner. I will definitely admit, like, you know, kids often ask her, living in Los Angeles, do you know X star? Do you know? And she's like, I have no idea what you're talking about, you know. But I think she also thinks that Sicily is the place her dad grew up. And so she's proud that she gets to spend time there. And the ways in which we are other there, which, you know, as Americans, as African Americans, we do sort of stand out, especially in the small town.
But there was like one other person you met, and one other Black person, right? The priest?
The priest,
yeah.
Yes, the African priest, who is an interim priest who comes during the summer when the main priest is, you know, sort of on sabbatical or on holiday. And so, you know, for me, I was like, hello, can we talk? Hi. And she's very much aware of that, too. I mean, some of the big questions we've had, you know, sort of about cultural fluency, right, which is what you learn when you're crossing language and geography and generations, as I said, you know, Zoella, this is a small place in the world that people have not immigrated to and from. And so, yes, we may be the only ones, but our stories here are quite similar to everybody else's.
I'm Chris Boyd, and we're listening back to my conversation with Tembi Locke, author of From Scratch, a memoir of love, Sicily, and finding home. When we return, Locke talks about what she learned about Saro's childhood from the stories of people in the community who watched him grow up.
He would be nimble to find his way towards something he wanted to do, which was really a part of who he was. It was how he got himself to Florence, and it's how he, quite frankly, I think, made it through all those years battling cancer, because he really understood that you have to bend with life as it comes, and he taught me that. And I could see, I could begin to trace a thread of that thinking, that way of engaging with life, all the way to Sicily.
That's when Think continues. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Tembi Locke, who joined me earlier this year to talk about her book From Scratch, a memoir of love, Sicily, and finding home. Let's go back to that conversation. What did you understand about your husband when you were in his hometown after he had died that you didn't understand about him before?
Sato was always a very incredibly poetic person. He'd actually studied to be a translator. That was what his first love was before he found his way to cooking and chef and being in the kitchen. And so I always sort of knew that that was in him, and he wrote poems to me, and it was something that I really thought, quite frankly, was just who he was. But when I got to Sicily, what I realized is that culturally it's because of the intersection of cultures in Sicily, Sicilians speak in a naturally poetic way. And because, especially agrarian Sicily, because people in a certain generation, because they're living so close to the land, the way they talk in metaphor, the way they talk about, the way they'll talk about use an artichoke to talk about pain. Right. or talk about the thorns of something and refer to, you know, a thistle. You know, it just, I thought, oh, my gosh, he grew up in and around this way of engaging with the world and a way of describing the natural world and how we fit into the natural world as humans. And so I really could see that more clearly, mostly because in the absence of his poetry, not being able to talk to him every day, when I would sit and have coffee in Aliminusas, the town, and hear people refer to things that I'd heard him refer to. I see. This is a part of who you are. And one of the things that, one of the greatest stories I heard was a gentleman stopped by the first summer I was there. I think it was in the first couple of days. And he said to me, I want to tell you a story of your husband. And I said, okay. And he said, when he was a boy, we went to play. He wanted to go play soccer in the fields above town. But he had only two pairs of shoes. And one was his church shoes. And he couldn't get those messed up. And so he said, well, I'll give you my shoes. And he said, but they're too big. And he said, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll put on multiple pairs of socks. So he got all the socks, you know, from his drawer and I guess his dad's drawer so that he could wear these shoes and go play soccer. And what that taught me hearing that story in the wake of his loss was I first of all saw a child. He'd never told me that story, first of all. But I saw my husband as a young boy and the sort of ingenuity of like, I want to do this thing. But I don't know how to do this thing. I don't want to get in trouble. Oh, maybe I'll, you know, that sort of the crafty way that he would be nimble to find his way towards something he wanted to do, which was really a part of who he was. It was how he got himself to Florence. And it's how he, quite frankly, I think, made it through all those years battling cancer, because he really understood that you have to bend with life as it comes. And he taught me that. And I could see, I could begin to trace a thread of that thinking, that way of engaging with life, all the way to Sicily.
So there are rules for being a wife, a mother, a caregiver, a widow in Southern California. But maybe they don't feel like rules because you're so familiar with the culture that you can sort of live within those variations. When you go somewhere else where you feel like maybe there's one set of rules and no one has told you what they are, how do you navigate and behave yourself and be yourself while also honoring what other people expect of you?
That was really, really hard for me initially. And it's the kind of, you know, I mentioned before, the cultural fluency, right? And every culture has different ways that they grieve. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, no one in L.A., unless you knew me, knew that I was grieving. Mm-hmm. Meaning I go to the supermarket, no one knows or cares. I shouldn't say they don't care, but, you know, it's not at the forefront, right? We don't wear black armbands anymore, so no one really knows. And so I could sort of grieve either under the radar or grieve quietly alone, but not openly here in the States and in Los Angeles. When I got to Sicily, where grieving is a communal experience, where it is done out in the open, where widows do wear black, I didn't know how to navigate all of that. And one of the things that I was very invested in was that my mother-in-law, that I not offend her in the way I grieved, because it might look different than the way she grieved. Mm-hmm. And so she wore black, always wore black, and I didn't. And I thought that might be the first sort of bump we had. We didn't. I think it did give her pause when I did wear the red, you know, petal pushers to walk out of the house, you know, because there's a way in the town where people really want to know that they are in solidarity with you around this loss. And the ways you do that publicly are quite sanctioned, especially for her generation. But she gave me a great deal of latitude. And I think she understood that what I might wear or how I might move in the world was no indication of any lack of love for her son. And so she really allowed me to be authentic in the way I chose to grieve and what that might look like, including when it was time for me to sort of, you know, move my married ring from my, you know, left hand to my right hand, right? And that was, she said, oh, you've changed your ring. And she notices, you know, mother-in-law, she notices, you know, just everything. And I said, I have. And she says, okay, that's okay.
You tell a funny story of her and your daughter Zoella, when Zoella was very little, arguing over what they were going to watch on TV.
Oh, yes. So my mother-in-law, at her home, three channels. So there's no satellite. There's no cable TV. And so at noon, it's whatever soap operas are on the three national, you know, Rye stations. And so she has two shows that she must watch from the 11 o'clock hour through the lunch hour. And my daughter had another thing that she wanted to watch. And so the two of them negotiating that, and my daughter's favorite show was a show called Don Mateo, which is about a, you know, a crime-solving priest
who like whips, you know, like a cell phone out of his robe, you know, and he's very unconventional. And he's also blonde hair and blue eyed. And so for my mother-in-law, I was like, who is that? That's not a priest. A priest right. doesn't, you know, talk on the cell phone and, you know, a priest doesn't, you know, do that. My daughter was fascinated with like solving the crimes. Mm-hmm. It was like Scooby-Doo meets a priest for her. So she just like loved this show.
And watching the two of them sort of figure out and the ways in which they had enough language to sort of kind of negotiate it. And then my mother-in-law saying, you know, fine, you can watch what you want, which I think was her way of saying, I want this child to feel as at home and relaxed as possible. And so she can do whatever she wants, which is what grandparents do right. often, right? That's the role of grandparents. And then my daughter saying, oh, I can go watch it across the street, you know, at Zia Messina's house, which, you know, my mother-in-law's cousin. So watching them sort of negotiate that intergenerational thing around a single TV, right? You know, because there's not like multiple TVs in her home was really beautiful. And I knew to stay out of it a little bit.
I would imagine that for your mother-in-law, the sort of eternal soul of her granddaughter is very important. And I would imagine she thinks there's one way for that eternal soul to be cared for. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I will share the story of a Halloween just after Sato passed, the first Halloween after Sato passed. And Zoella decided that year that she wanted to dress up as a devil. Which for my mother-in-law, in a very Sicilian traditional Catholic family, she said, first of all, she doesn't believe in Halloween. Second of all, the fact that my daughter was, you know, in a devil costume was like, okay, what is going on here? That cannot,
You're dressing my granddaughter as Satan.
As Satan, right? What is happening in America, right?
And so she said, so she got on the phone with Zoella and she said, Zoella, I know you and I know your heart. And so if you must wear that costume, it's okay. But please, when you get home, take it off and throw it away. So this idea of, you know, like she's sort of trying to sort of, you know, assert her influence from afar, right? And sort of shape the life of her granddaughter through these generational differences, cultural differences. And it's sweet to watch. And then my daughter to say, Nonna's really worried about this. I just thought it was a cool costume. And I said, yeah, this is, you're beginning to have the first lessons around how different people engage and think about life and the world. And the same thing can have two different meanings for people. And she's like, oh, okay, well, we just don't have to show her pictures. But can I keep the costume? I was like, of course you can keep the costume.
We're going to go to the phone now. We've got Jean in Dallas. Hi, Jean.
Oh, hi, Chris. Thank you so much. And thank you, Ms. Timby, for this book. My book club is reading it right now, and they're enthralled. The feedback is just fabulous. There's a lot of crying and emotion. But I'll be leading the discussion, and I wanted to ask you, from an author's perspective, what is the one message that I should convey during the discussion that you really want to get across about your book? And I'll take my response off the air.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much. Thank you for reading the book as a part of your book club. And I have to say that for me, the overarching message of the book is about love. The book is really a love letter to love. And it's a love letter to all of the different paradigms of love. And of course, it moves from the romantic love, the eros, as the Greeks talk about, to that agape, that big love. And so I hope readers take away from the book is that love, when we lean into it, even through the most difficult moments, is greater and bigger than our wildest imaginings. And it is bigger than any geography, any language, any single culture. And it can really be a healing and uniting and unifying.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The story of Icarus comes up in this book, mm-hmm. and you had this thought that maybe you and Sato had such a perfect relationship that you just flew too close to the sun.
Yep. I was at the Temple of Hera in Agrigento, which is on the southern side of Sicily. And that first summer, I became sort of obsessed with sort of retracing the steps that he and I had been to on the island of Sicily. And I needed to go to this temple. I just needed to go to the valley of the temples. And I think unconsciously, I was trying to bring myself closer to an understanding of timelessness. I don't think I could have ever articulated that at the moment. But when I was standing there and I was trying to explain to my daughter why we were in this hot place, this dusty valley of like ancient, you know, temples that are crumbling. And she's like, Mommy, why are we here? And the only thing I could think of was the story of Icarus, mostly because I knew she understood Greek mythology. It was something she and her dad had shared. And so I told her the story of Icarus. And I said, this is where, you know, he took off. I'm like literally as a parent, you know, sort of just flying by the seat of my pants, making stuff up, you know, on the fly, literally. But after that, I thought about that. And I thought, oh, that story. And was this life that I had with Sato, in all of its perfect imperfections, did we fly too close to the sun? And now I'm living with that the aftermath of that. I can say now, 8 years after his passing, we don't have a story of it. We've flown into our wingspan. And I think that that's the thing that we can all do in life, is just try to fly to our maximum wingspan. We can't control what's going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen, but we can extend ourselves to our maximum. And I think that's a part of our story.
Do you remember the first time you thought, you realized you were going to be okay?
It came to me in small incremental bits. One of the things that someone first said to me was, you'll know when you laugh and you don't know that you're laughing.
Huh. I'm laughing, but maybe I shouldn't be, or I'm...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because I had, laughing was so hard initially. And when it came, it would shock me and surprise me. And I was like, oh, I just laughed. Oh. And then there came a time when I would laugh and I didn't have to editorialize the fact that I laughed. It was just a part of my living. And I might cry 5 minutes later, but the two could be side by side. And when I understood that the two could be side by side and that I could go forward, or as they say in Sicily, tirarsi avanti, you know, kind of pull yourself forward, which is a really beautiful verb, the pulling part, mm-hmm. you know, that's, I think, when I, laughter for me.
Is there an Italian translation of this book, and have all of your mother-in-law's neighbors read it?
It's not out yet. So no, they haven't. When they do, it'll be very interesting because, you know, there's some things that nobody, you know, knew until I wrote them down. I'm sure there'll be some interesting conversations, and it's a small town, so.
Word gets around.
Yeah.
That was my conversation with Tembi Locke. She joined us earlier this year to talk about her book, From Scratch, a memoir of love, Sicily, and finding home. If you enjoyed this show, check out our conversations with journalist Anna Mailer Paperny about her book, Hello, I Want to Die, Please Fix Me, Depression in the First Person, and with psychologist George A. Bonanno about his book, The Other Side of Sadness, What the New Science of Bereavement Tells Us About Life After Loss. Those podcasts are on our website, think.kera.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.